Hello, welcome to episode 55 of the Structure and Interpretation of Computer Programmers podcast. Yes, I am restarting this podcast. It's been nearly 4 years since the last episode, but now I have more time available as I've voluntarily left paid work to focus on helping software engineers improve their craft, and this podcast becomes part of that assistance. I don't make any money other than what you, my audience, give me to support this shift in my lifestyle, and the vehicle you use to provide that support is over on my Patreon. This podcast will remain on this feed, and there's other stuff that I share first, or even exclusively, over on the Patreon. Let me give you a quick pitch for that. My message to software engineers is, your job is safe. If you're worried about whether AI means that there'll be less need for software engineers in the next few years and that you need to retrain, don't be. Once the field shakes out the adoption problems, identifies the tools that will work, and adapts its ways of working, this will unlock the huge latent demand for software that we're still not meeting. There will be more people in software, not fewer. So, yes, there will still be need for software engineers, and yes, you will need to retrain. Because the role will, of course, change. And that's what Chiron Codex is for. I want to help you understand that you can use AI coding assistance and not only remain in control of the software you create, but create better software by augmenting your skills and capabilities using those of the AI. In the short term, I'm sharing techniques for interacting with chat-based coding assistants like Gemini CLI, Claude Code, or ChatGPT Codex that help you get better results or refine your ideas in ways that weren't available before. These techniques come loaded with examples, and the Companion Agent Skills Repository makes them ready to use. I'll build out training, more agent skills and sub-agent prompts, and new tools to help you become a software engineering centaur instead of outsourcing your understanding to the computer. Now, that doesn't mean that the SICPAS podcast is becoming AI-focused, and indeed it isn't, for this simple reason. While the tools we have to apply software engineering knowledge might be changing, the actual knowledge areas, the need to understand systems and requirements, architecture, design and trade-offs, verification, validation, performance and more, all of that remains the same. So what I'll do in this podcast is survey what we already know about software engineering through the lens of particular works. Works from practitioners, consultants, researchers, and from adjacent fields, with a focus on the classics that people come back to decade after decade. I'll look at what this literature teaches us about software and how we incorporate that knowledge into our work, with or without AI support. I hope you join me on this journey. Remember, you can support this podcast over on the Patreon, and that's the only thing that contributes to my mortgage so that I can make these episodes. But the best way to help out is to tell one or more of your friends and colleagues about the podcast and recommend that they give it a listen. I'm always open to conversations and feedback. You can comment on the post for this podcast or send me an email at grahamlee@acm.org. That's grahamlee@acm.org. With that pitch and that explanation for the radio silence over the last few years out of the way, let's get into the topic for episode 55, which is Ed Yourdon's book, Death March, all about people and project management. Ed Yourdon was a software consultant and a prolific author during the end of the 20th and beginning of the 21st centuries. In fact, he was one of the people who was most vocal in reporting the issues of Y2K and of warning people of the risks associated with not updating software, which led to his reputation taking a bit of a hit when the year 2000 came and went without any big catastrophes But of course, the reason that things went so smoothly is that there was a massive effort to update all of this software, and that, you know, Edward Jordan's warnings were one of the reasons that people took this idea so seriously. This is unfortunately a recurring problem in software, that if you fix a problem before it becomes a disaster, people assume you haven't done anything. However, the first edition of the Death March book was in 1995, and the second was in 2004, so he was able to keep some form of professional name and to carry on publishing beyond Y2K. So the first question that we have to ask about a Death March project is how we define a project to be in a Death March. And Jordan's definition is that any of the project parameters in this project exceed the norm by at least 50%. So for example, the schedule is less than half of that arrived at by rational estimates. The headcount is less than half the usual number for such a project, or the budget or associated resources for the project have been cut in half. Now, it may seem that in our modern era of agile projects and sprints, this is a bit of an outdated idea. So, you know, why should I pick this book and this topic of Death March projects? Unfortunately, it's because I've seen a lot of Death March projects in recent years, including on projects that are notionally run according to agile principles, because the fundamental drivers of a death march are not technological, they are political in nature. One company that I saw still had death march projects because while they had switched to monthly sprints, they still had a project scope defined by annual conference attendance and the ability to release a new version of their product at the conference every year, which meant that they had a feature list that they promised at one conference and aimed to deliver at the next conference without taking a reasonable approach to estimation, and so without guaranteeing that the project was, you know, rationally able to fit within that 12-month gap. Other projects I've seen have been hobbled by technical debt practices, and so the ability to deliver over time gets reduced as the complexity of working in the code gets greater, with the result that what would previously have taken one iteration, sprint, whatever you want to call it, to deliver, starts to take longer. And as soon as it takes two sprints, you have doubled the rational estimate for delivering the feature. If you try to do it in one sprint, you're on a Death March project. And so, unfortunately, I do still see Death March projects, even where each of the Death Marches is allegedly a 2-week sprint or a 1-month iteration. So Ed Jordan draws, as any valid consultant does in order to earn their money, a quadrant diagram to categorize the four types of sprint. If you don't see a quadrant diagram in a book by a consultant, then perhaps the editor decided they needed to save a page, but it was definitely there in the draft. And his quadrants are, on the one axis, whether the chance of success is lower or higher. He doesn't say low or high, because by definition a Death March project has a low chance of success. Like, one of the project parameters is wrong by a factor of 50% at least. And on the other axis, and this might be surprising, but he has whether there is a low or a high level of happiness. This goes back to the idea that a Death March project is political in nature. People are participating in it for various reasons, not least of which being the perception of not having an alternative. You know, if the market, as it was in 2003, just after the dot-com crash and 9/11, is in a poor state, as it also was immediately after the global financial crisis and immediately after COVID-19. In fact, you know, I would go as far as to say that we are still in the post-COVID-19 slump. Then many of the employees, whether they are managers, project managers, programmers, testers, operations staff, whoever they are, may feel like they have no choice but to continue in their current job. Of course, upturns in the market can lead to Death March projects as well, because you might plan and scope out a project with a team of people, and then the higher performance people on the team will go and get higher paid jobs somewhere else, and you're left with your existing schedule, your existing commitments, and fewer staff. So we see death marches in times of boom and times of bust. But other reasons for people to participate include heroism. If you're on one of those high happiness, relatively high chance of success projects, that's a kind of mission impossible. There may be great reward, or at least great recognition for completing the project, no matter how unlikely that seems. People may be naive and not realise that the project they're signing up to is a death march. Or there might be career progression or resume padding opportunities. Maybe this project is a chance to implement AI augmented blockchain in the company, and it's the only such project that's ever going to be initiated. And so you participate whatever the likelihood of success, just so you can have those technologies on your CV. Now, with the core properties of the Death March project typically being political rather than technical, we might find that market constraints or miscommunication with customers lead to aggressive deadlines or misunderstood requirements. And a lot of Jordan's recommendations for dealing with Death March projects are political in nature. They largely involve the project manager trying to save the project, both from its own staff, who may be willing to try many things or give up on certain pieces of work. You know, I remember back in my first programming job, I was on a project that became a death march, effectively because they asked the wrong people to estimate it. Now, on the one hand, this project was run as a typical waterfall project, and this would have been in approximately 2007. So we already knew all of the problems with waterfall, but the engineering management at this company were insistent on the kind of phased approach to running the project, with managerial review at phase exit gates. And that meant that the first thing that the team had to do was estimate how long it would take them to complete the project. Well, the team, being me, who was in my first programming job, another programmer who was in their first job full stop out of university, and a third programmer who was an experienced member of the company, having worked there for 5 years, but who had never worked on the technology that this project was integrating with. So we were really the wrong people to estimate this project. We were very naive, very optimistic and came up with a completely unworkable project schedule. That project had many of the features that Jordan describes in the Death March, including people suggesting that we like give up on basic accessibility or usability requirements, or on even on like quality assurance tasks, so that we finished something at some time rather than like delivering a good product at the time that it was ready. And indeed, a lot of Jordan's recommendations are either trying to save the project from its own team members who engage in this kind of behavior, or trying to rescue the project from the company management, who are going to take a bit more of a keen interest because this project seems to be going off the rails, particularly if the project is going to be one of the like high visibility projects for the company, or creates a new product that their customers are relying on. So some of these recommendations do kind of seem a bit dated now, like they're situated in the context of what you could get away with in employer-employee relations in 2003. But on the other hand, I've seen some of these relatively recently before. Overtime, better office conditions, evening pizza orders. Those are all things that I see Silicon Valley companies doing, and even preemptively doing it to get project members into the Death March mindset. Now, I used to work at one of the large Silicon Valley companies that's most famous for its social networking products, and there the office had three free cooked meals a day in the refectory, drinks and snacks available for free at any time of day, and a workplace social program where you got financial support for a social event if a group of employees met at the office and left for this event in the evening. I think the particular criterion was after 7 p.m. That obviously encourages people to still be in the office after 7 p.m, as does the free cooked dinner, and so therefore you build a Death March mentality where people give you overtime for free, and then you don't need to be rational in your estimation processes because you can always assume that free overtime is available. Another of his suggestions from the kind of office arrangement perspective is to take the team out somewhere else and have them work in like a skunkworks facility, like a warehouse across town from the office. This is again related to the idea that you want to kind of take them away from the regular management oversight so they can actually focus on getting the work done, but also kind of embed them in this like high urgency environment where everyone understands what the mission is and how important it is to get it done. And like the idea of war rooming is still prevalent amongst some of these larger software companies. But some of his other recommendations represent a partial acceptance of what would have been the radical but broadening in adoption new idea at the time of agile software development. And don't forget that even though the manifesto was published in 2001, the people who were talking about it had been talking about it for a good few years beforehand, and that these were software methodologists who were talking with like regular software companies all the time. So Jordan would have been very aware of their work and of their recommendations and of the likelihood of success or otherwise of following these recommendations. So there is actually a section in his chapter on triage about adopting XP. And the reason for that is that his triage chapter is about saying, well, let's accept that this project isn't going to go successfully if we do it the way that we're going to do it. So let's ask the customer what the most important things are and give them those first, and like work with the customer frequently to reprioritize the requirements, to get their feedback and to update what we're doing based on what they need. Customer collaboration over contract negotiation and valuing the continuous delivery of working software to the customer. Focus the process on meaningful contributions. Indeed, later chapters discuss continuous delivery even. There's a section on having a daily build. Now, the Death March project I talked about before, early in my career, could not have had a daily build because the build was very strongly handheld. We used Perforce as our version control system, and the build definition was a change set that pointed at a file that listed components and a change set of those components to check out. And because there was an air-gapped network, someone would take that build specification, check out the requested source. Because we were building for a Unix product and the build team was using Windows, frequently we would get problems where binary files had Windows line endings, where a new line character in the binary file had been replaced by a carriage return and a new line when it was checked out, and so the build would fail. So we had kind of build failures of at least 50%. But nonetheless, having checked out the source, they would then burn it to a CD and take that over to their build network, run the CD through an antivirus program on the air-gapped, in the air-gapped build room, and then copy that source onto the build computer to run the build. So a daily build would have literally taken like an employee to run. These days you can build your software multiple times a day, and so we're used to continuous delivery, where even the daily build might even go into production, or we have feature flags, so the code changes are getting integrated every day, and that is going into the build every day, even if the new features aren't necessarily available for the customer to use. But daily builds in 2003, Microsoft were doing this for Windows. I don't know how prevalent it was, but this was continuous delivery. This is the goal of continuous delivery, is just to make sure that the software you're working on is available for the customer so that they can adapt to it as quickly as possible, so that the rest of the project team can integrate and adapt to the software that you've built as soon as they can. He also talked about the risks of assuming that new processes or new tools could save the day, though, and so contextually we understand why his recommendations for things like XP were guarded. He's talking about the idea that there are people who just believe that some new process or new tool is going to be a silver bullet, and that if only you would adopt that, you will absolutely turn your fortunes around. The risk with that, particularly on a Death March project, and he explains this in the book, is that everybody has to learn and master this new tool or this new process to be effective. And in the short term, that slows the project down, just as adding new people would, according to Fred Brooks. There's a load of communication that has to be done, a load of learning, a load of practice. And so let's imagine that you're working on a Death March project in Ruby on Rails, and someone says, well, if only we used Elixir and Phoenix, we'd get this project done much quicker. Is that much quicker after you have learned how to be productive with Elixir and Phoenix? Or is that much quicker assuming that you already know how to use them? Or is that just wishful thinking and the person wants to put those technologies on their resume? Now, an interesting recommendation at the end of the book, I don't think I've ever seen put into practice, is what he calls war gaming, which is the idea of preparing people for projects that go wrong or that require adaptation or that become death marches by letting them participate in simulated projects and simulating particular events, for example, half of the staff leaving or the customer deciding that they need the software much earlier than you had previously assumed, or the estimates being incredibly wrong. I don't know that I have ever seen a software company simulate a project at all, or even inject a simulated catastrophe or failure into a real project for resilience testing. I've seen, like, certainly kind of like technological simulations, like fake data center outages or like red teaming, and what are basically simulated cyber attacks. But I don't know that I've ever seen a software company simulate a software project or inject a simulated event into a real software project just to see whether people are ready and whether the organization is ready to adapt to it. That is an interesting idea that still belongs in the future, despite this second edition of this book being written in 2004. So sadly, I think that death marches are still relevant, and that Ed Yourdon's book still has something to teach us, particularly on the kind of agile projects that are called Dark Scrum by Ron Jeffries, and that are all too common. I'd love to hear what you think. You can comment on the post for this podcast. You can send me an email, grahamlee@acm.org. Or if you join the Patreon, you can join the community and get involved in the chat over there. So thank you for listening. I don't entirely know when the next episode is going to come out, but I'm going to aim for a monthly cadence. So I hope to talk to you again very soon.